for State Technology and Regulatory Council. Welcome to today's training. Today's class is Remediation Management of Complex Sites. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the training over to our ITRC trainers. Today's training is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Remediation Management of Complex Sites. And at this point, if you could check to be sure that your phone is muted at your location. It sounds like we are picking up a little bit of background noise, and that can be kind of disruptive. So definitely double check to make sure if you are joining us on the phone line that you have your phone muted. If you are joining us on the computer speaker, you're all set. We are not picking up any audio through our computer speaker, so great way to do the training. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session, and we do offer archives of past ITRC classes. During today's training, our trainers control the slides. If you would like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where we started today. And it's also available through our related links in the middle right. So you see the CLUIN training page. Select that, look down a bit, select Browse To. That's going to allow that link to open in a new window. We are looking for your questions and feedback throughout today's training class. So you're welcome to type in a question in the Q&A pod. In some cases, we'll ask those questions out loud during our question and answer breaks. We're going to have one in the middle and another at the end of today's presentation. At the end of the class, we do look for everyone to fill out the feedback form. And it's available in the link on the last slide. And if you have to leave before we wrap up, again, those related links, the feedback form is one of the options. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if that's something you can use, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. Once you submit, the system will generate a certificate for you. And right now, the only way to get that is through the feedback form. So be sure to fill out the feedback form and check the box at the bottom to get your certificate. More information about ITRC is available on the website, which is itrcweb.org. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators and includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We do encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We do ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your success. Use of ITR materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on ITRC at the website. There are teams working on new topics, so you can look to see if you are interested in joining an ITRC team. There is a wide variety of guidance documents available. We also have our online and classroom schedule available for all of 2018. All of our trainers today were members of the ITRC team. You can read their bios on the CLUIN training page, and we have a link here at the bottom right to that CLUIN training page so that you can access that. Our trainers today are John Price at the Washington Department of Ecology, Roy Thun at GHD, Claudia Walika Hutchinson at the Dow Chemical Company, Elizabeth Hawley at Geosyntech Consultants, and Sam Brock at AFCEC. I'll now turn today's presentation over to John Price from the Washington Department of Ecology. John?
Okay. Julianne, I may have lost control of my slides here, so if you hear me say next, go ahead and do that. I'll just go ahead and launch in, so if you'd hit the next slide for me. Okay, so we have on the call today, we have people from all over the United States and all over the world. There, I got it back. Thank you. So we have collectively thousands of years of experience with environmental remediation, but for many of us, complete remediation is still a significant challenge at our sites. We may have taken care of the immediate risk to human health, the environment, but it might be decades or even longer to reach regulatory standards. At other sites, remediation progress may be uncertain. Although each site is unique, a lot of us are already applying parts of the approach that we'll talk about today, adaptive site management, maybe without calling it that. The RTRC team came up with the following description of a complex site, a site where remediation progress is uncertain and remediation is not expected to achieve closure or even long-term management within a reasonable time frame. So here's a couple of examples of complex sites. Many more are presented in the case studies associated with this guidance document. The first photo on the upper left is an aerial view of the Rocky Flat site in Colorado. This former U.S. Department of Energy facility is 10 square miles and was used for manufacturing parts for nuclear weapons. The $7 billion cleanup was completed in October 2005 and at the time was the largest environmental cleanup of a CERCLA site. Our case study featured remediation efforts at just one of the four groundwater plumes, which was sourced from five solar evaporation ponds that were used to store low-level radioactive waste and other waste. The commingled uranium and nitrate plume covered 50 acres. The second photo shows investigation work in a congested residential area affected by vapor intrusion and groundwater contamination downgradient of the Moffett Field, Middlefield, Ellis, Wisman, and I'll call it MEW site on future slides in California. This site is complex because of multiple source areas, multiple responsible parties addressing commingled plumes, multiple aquifers, eight zones, geologic heterogeneities, multiple exposure pathways, and residential land use. That's a mouthful, and these sites give you a flavor for the challenges we have to face. Okay, this ITRC team started from a National Research Council report in 2013 that sparked interest in forming guidance for complex sites. The Research Council report estimated that approximately 10% of 126,000 sites across the United States are complex, with a total cost to complete of $127 billion. More recently, in 2017, the U.S. Government Accounting Office estimated that federal government environmental liabilities are $450 billion, which is up from $212 billion in 1997. So even though we're finishing a lot of these sites, the costs continue to climb. Okay, this ITRC guidance is for state regulators, site owners, their representatives, and other stakeholders working at complex sites. The team that wrote this guidance was large and diverse, almost 200 team members, the largest at the time team in ITRC history, with representatives from different groups. This guidance presents a recommended approach for remediation management at complex sites termed adaptive site management. This guidance incorporates best management practices, existing tools, and technologies described in previous publications by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, ITRC itself, the Department of Defense, and others, and we've pulled those together in this one guidance. We've included 16 case studies where regulatory decisions have been made, but for many of these case studies, it will take decades to establish whether site objectives have been met. I love the case studies, which allow me to calibrate my own experience with what others have accomplished. Stakeholder perspectives at complex sites are also summarized. One thing you can do at your own complex site is go around to different parties and ask them what is their definition of success for the site. You'll likely hear different answers from the site owner, consultants, regulators, and community interest groups. Okay, this slide provides a roadmap to today's training, which follows the organization and the guidance. Following the introduction, which I'm giving, we'll talk about site challenges. We'll talk about a tool called remediation potential assessment. We'll talk about adaptive remedy selection, and we'll talk about long-term management. We'll highlight case studies throughout, and we'll talk about stakeholder engagement throughout the training. Stakeholder engagement is summarized in chapters 6 and 7 of the guidance. This flow chart shows the adaptive site management process, and the color coding corresponds with each chapter where the steps are discussed in detail. Adaptive site management is a comprehensive, flexible, and iterative process that's well-suited for complex sites where there's significant uncertainty in remedy performance predictions. Adaptive site management involves periodically, that's the iteration, evaluating and adjusting the remedial approach against interim objectives. It may involve multiple technologies at any one time and changes in technology over time. The figure up here on the screen is small, but there is a full-page version of the flowchart available under additional resources, and this figure was also provided along with your registration information. Okay, so what are the benefits of adaptive site management? Why should we use it? First of all, let's be clear, it does not offer shortcuts or the means to avoid site remediation. We'll continue to maintain protection of human health and the environment and fulfill regulatory requirements. Adaptive site management can improve site decisions and streamline decision making, decreasing remediation costs in the long term and potentially reducing remediation timeframes. It can help establish milestones that demonstrate interim progress that eventually leads to the long-term goal. It reduces potential technical, regulatory, and procedural barriers to using various remediation approaches that exist but are infrequently practiced. It encourages returning all or part of the site to beneficial reuse earlier in the remediation lifecycle as remediation milestones are reached, while recognizing that additional time is needed to achieve overall site objectives. Okay, here's another case study. I mentioned earlier we don't always call it adaptive site management when we're applying it. This is a site where the site operator very deliberately applied adaptive site management, the Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida. Adaptive site management at this facility facilitated discontinuing some interim remedial actions for which decisions had already been made, and they went on to conduct additional site characterization so that they could reduce the remaining site risk. They found some site risks they hadn't realized at first. The site moved to a risk-based remediation approach supported by technology demonstrations. Okay, I mentioned stakeholder once already, and we'll keep emphasizing the importance of involving stakeholders. Stakeholders include all groups and individuals potentially impacted by the project. At complex sites, there may be multiple stakeholder groups, and they likely have a long site history to take into account. Again, Chapter 6 and 7 talk about stakeholder engagement and provide a stakeholder perspective about concerns at complex sites. It's important to involve stakeholders early, build trust, foster respect, and improve quality of decisions. It's important to have a relationship with stakeholders, not just run a process for stakeholder engagement. Frequently, stakeholders enter the remediation process with different goals or priorities than responsible parties or regulators. That's to be expected. Stakeholder groups may have competing interests or perspectives among themselves. But our experience across the U.S. has shown that robust stakeholder involvement can enhance community acceptance to the remedies by modifying plans and activities and by informing stakeholders about the existing program. Okay, we talked about the MEW site once already. Community members were a constructive part of this decision making, and they were on our ITRC team. They actually nominated this case study for inclusion in our guidance. The stakeholders at this site influenced changes to the characterization program and to the selected remedy. They essentially became part of the remedy, which is kind of unusual, because they recommended local zoning and permitting requirements that address the vapor intrusion problems at this site. So looking at this case study is an example of how remediation process and outcomes can be improved because of stakeholder involvement. Okay. So what should you be able to do after today's training? You should be able to identify and integrate technical and non-technical site challenges into a holistic approach. So we're going to talk about those technical and non-technical challenges in another section. You're going to use a tool called the Remediation Potential Assessment to identify whether adaptive site management is warranted at your site due to site complexity. You'll understand and apply adaptive site management principles and understand how to develop a long-term performance-based action plan. Again, we're going to talk about effective stakeholder engagement, and you'll be able to access additional resources, tools, and case studies that are most relevant for complex sites. I love those case studies. And we want you at the end to communicate the value of this guidance to regulators, practitioners, community members, and others. Okay, so again, this is today's roadmap. We're going to talk about site challenges next, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Roy Thun with GHD.
Great. Thanks, John. I appreciate it. As John mentioned, I'll be talking in this section on our Chapter 2, which is the site challenges. And what site challenges, as you see in the little orange box on slide 17, we're looking to identify and integrate those technical and non-technical site challenges into a holistic approach to remediation. And really what we're attempting to do here is marry that technical and non-technical challenges to create a better conceptual site model. And these are, in fact, the challenges that make a site complex. I'm hoping through this particular section that I can help you improve your awareness of these challenges and also help you improve and identify the path for your particular site. Later on, you'll learn how to quantify these challenges and create a holistic adaptive site management plan. But before we get too deep into it, the question of, you know, what is a complex site? And so we'll start off with the Tri-State Mining District case study, which is in the guidance. Here we have a 2,500 square mile, that's 2,500 square mile, widespread contaminated soil, groundwater, and surface water site. So just asking everybody, you don't need to unmute, but, you know, thinking about it, would you consider this to be a complex site? And I would guess most of you probably would consider it would be complex. And what you'll learn through this section is that, you know, the size of a site is really just one factor that can lead to its complexity. John had mentioned had stated what the definition of a complex site is. And I wanted to cover that just a little bit more. Here on slide 19, we've got to discuss the definition of complex site again. And before I bring it up again, I want to just note some of the backdrop. Now, we had hundreds of people on this team, and we debated for weeks the definition of a complex site. Many people had different views on this. Many groups had different views on this, whether they're academia, stakeholders, regulators, industries, et cetera. Ultimately, we came up to this definition. You know, at complex sites, remediation progress is uncertain, and remediation is not anticipated to achieve closure or even long-term management within a reasonable time frame. What we learn is that remediation is, what we know is remediation is inherently difficult, even at simple sites. And you see this term in here, reasonable time frame. Now, that's an important phrase here because it really does tie back to the issue of complexity. And if you have unlimited time, perhaps no site would really be complex, right? But what we don't want you to do is to get hung up on this term, complex sites. It is just a term that is used to help us understand a category of sites that have these challenges that make it difficult to achieve your long-term objectives in a reasonable time frame. So with that, let's now, let me click to the next slide here. I already talked about the fact that we're going to discuss the technical and non-technical challenges. And then, of course, I'd mentioned previously that really it's identifying these challenges that's going to help us improve the CSM and maximize that remedial effectiveness. But I do want to come back to this issue of a reasonable time frame. So with that, if we can bring up the poll, Juliana. So you'll have a little poll coming up on the bottom of your screen. And we're asking you the question of which remediation time frame usually makes for a complex site. And you can see your options. You may have to scroll down to see them all. Greater than 10 years, greater than 30 years, greater than 60 years, greater than 100 years, or time frame does not determine site complexity. So I'll give you a moment to think about that, and then we'll see what you all have to say about it. Okay. So as the polling's coming in, we're getting an interesting split. The group is almost split evenly between greater than 30 years and time frame does not determine site complexity. So interesting. So we asked the same question of our state points of contact, and what we found, we can take the poll away, Juliana. Thank you. And what we found was, similar to many of you, there was no consensus. The states that we polled, you know, thought that remedial time frame really didn't determine site complexity. And what that really led us to recognize was that the relationship between a site's remedial time frame and complexity is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. And part of the reason why we think this is occurring is that there really is no strong state or federal regulations or guidance to help define it. So it leaves it kind of ambiguous from state to state, or even through federal jurisdictions such as EPA on a CERCLA site. But what we do know is that it's best if you can define a time frame based on those site objectives that are considerate of both the technical and non-technical challenges for a site. Too often we get married to just the technical aspects of a site, and we forget about how the non-technical aspects can influence a site as well. And we're going to discuss those technical and non-technical challenges and how they impact the real time frame next. So in Chapter 2 on the site challenges, we divided up the challenges into these two broad categories, technical and non-technical. And these, what you see, of course, is a variety of under each of the things that we'll be covering, geologic, hydrogeologic as examples under technical, and under non-technical, things like site objectives or the use of institutional controls or even funding. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go forward. So we'll start off in the technical realm. And our first example or area under the technical is geologic conditions. These are things like, heterogeneity or preferential flow path, fractured bedrock, karst bedrock, low permeability media. And the insert photo image that you're seeing on the right side of your screen, you can see those are clay units that are dipping from your upper left to your lower right. And this is a great example of a stratigraphic heterogeneity that could occur. Now, just imagine that you're coming to your site and you don't see this. You can't see this in cross-section. And so you put your wells in and you're doing your investigation on, the distance of the plume that you're trying to track. And without knowing what's occurring, this information could be interpreted much differently if you thought all these wells were connected, when in fact the red lines that you're seeing on here are actually showing that there's very little connectivity between those wells. So this is the type of complexity or challenges that we all face at sites, and understanding on the technical side this type of challenge, in this case geologic heterogeneity, is so important to developing an accurate conceptual site model. Probably not telling you anything you don't know, but again, the emphasis on this guidance is to help bring all these pieces together to develop the best site objectives you can to achieve them in a reasonable time frame. Another technical challenge is the hydrogeologic conditions. This is where you have extreme or variable groundwater velocities or fluctuating water table, maybe deep contamination, situations where surface water and groundwater actions are an impacted sediment. And the example here is another case study that we have in the guidance, and this is the Savannah River site in South Carolina. This had a pretty complicated CSM because of these interactions that you can see, bring up my pointer here, with this groundwater plume that's occurring in this fleshy, orangey, yellowish tone, and then the clays above. But what complicated, of course, is that groundwater plume is manifesting in the riparian zone, into sediments, and then ultimately into that 4-mile branch river. And so it's those types of things that can, wreak havoc on trying to understand what the dynamics of the system are. So there are other sites that we also have as case studies. I think John may have mentioned the Hanford site, where you had contamination down to 250 feet, the Velsicol site in Michigan, where we had a rising groundwater table, which really complicated the understanding of the fate and transport model. We'll continue on. Another area is geochemical conditions. Now, geochemical conditions are interesting because these are typically more remote sites that where this occurs. This is areas where you have an alkalinity issue or salinity hardness, or it could be an extreme groundwater temperature issue such as geothermal or low temperature permafrost. And one of the things that we see characteristically of these sites with geochemical conditions is that there's often limited technology options for them. They're also, again, tend to be more remote. They have a higher energy and carbon footprint cost remediation is typically higher. But if there's any positive of it, because of the remoteness from dense populations, there's also less exposure to those populations. And the example you're seeing on your page, that's a picture of the North Pole refinery in Alaska. Now, I'm a Southern California kid, so you know, I look at this and saying, even on my worst day, would I not want to, in California, would I want to step out into that particular environment? My blood is much too thin to survive there for long. So moving on, we have contaminant-related conditions. And when we talk about contaminant-related conditions, you know, some of the things are these light or dense non-aqueous phase liquids, the NAPLs, right? You have the L-NAPLs, things like gasoline that are the floaters, or the D-NAPLs, the sinkers, things like PCE that tend to go to the bottom of the formation, and they'll follow the geology. Recalcitrant contaminants like metals, or you could have high concentrations of multiple contaminants, and there's these emerging contaminants. A couple of the items to highlight here, you know, ITRC is a great resource for many different guidance documents to help practitioners understand their particular situations better. With respect to DNAPLs in 2000, I think the DNAPL was actually developed in 2011. That's the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy Guidance. That's still today used very widely by consultants and even regulatory agencies to help understand the issues associated with DNAPLs. ITRC last year came out with several fact sheets on these per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. Many of you are probably becoming more and more familiar with PFAS. It's almost ubiquitous in our groundwater around the world because of its prevalent use over the last 40 years. And, you know, Teflon, 3M products, et cetera, even our cookware has it. But luckily, ITRC's team has developed great fact sheets on the history of it and the chemical properties. There's a new one coming out on the, aqueous film forming, if I get this, AFFF, I always get the acronym wrong, but that one will be coming out soon, and that'll help those in the firefighting side of the use of these per and polyfluoroalkyl substances to understand, you know, their situations better and perhaps how to best manage it. So those things are available to you as well. So moving on, we can't forget about large-scale sites, right? You know, sites that have the location and extent of the contamination, just the breadth of it makes it much more difficult to deal with. Depth of contamination we mentioned, and the number and type or the proximity receptors. Having extensive or commingled plumes are an issue. We look again on the inset here on the tri-state mining site. You know, what's interesting about tri-state mining, besides just its size, is the reality that it actually straddles three different states and two EPA regions. So imagine just coordinating agency input for decision-making with that type of challenge. And even things such as underground utilities are substantially more complicated when you're dealing with contamination of this aerial extent. Now, in stark contrast to tri-state mining, we have the UGI Columbia gas plant site. I'm on slide 27, in case those of you are following on paper. Now, at this site, it's only 1.5 acres in size, and this is also a case study in the guidance. It's about 400 feet from the Susquehanna River. You had 100 years of gas manufacturing, and unfortunately, there were overflows from a tar separator that entered the river and, of course, got into the sediments, groundwater, and then deep into fractured bedrock. And what was understood is that tar would slowly dissolve, but over centuries. So what this site really tells us that even small sites can have very difficult technical challenges. So now that we've given you a glimpse of the types of technical challenges, it's time to turn to look at those non-technical challenges. So non-technical challenges are nothing new to us. They pretty much exist at every site. And one of the interesting factors of non-technical challenges is that the more technically challenging a site is, often the longer it will take to achieve those site objectives. And interestingly enough, this makes those non-technical challenges become more evident. And what we're talking about are things like these site objectives, where you could be changing site objectives depending on what phase of the site you're in, or you have societal expectations to integrate into the site objectives. And of course, we're all seeking to have a lower carbon footprint and more sustainable remedies that we try and consider into our site remediation plan. Managing those changes over long time frames is an issue, things like future use changes or even changes in site management. And we can't forget regulatory, where you have federal and state cooperation being so critical, but sometimes not necessarily folks getting along as well as they should. I'm sure many of you have been caught into that situation, and that's a huge challenge. You have changing laws and regulations. And you can't forget the issue of these orphan sites. You know, these are sites where the responsible party is either non-existent or lacks financial resources to fund the cleanup. And there's the contaminant without regulatory guidance and criteria. Really, PFAS is fitting in that category. We're slowly getting to the point where we're understanding it better, and states are working towards, as well as the federal government here in the U.S., on the appropriate regulatory thresholds for action. There's also, if I can highlight here, we use my pointer, down here, reference to GSR. That's ITRC's Green and Sustainable Remediation Document. That came out in 2012. A lot of these non-technical challenges are actually referenced in that guidance. That's a nice reference for you all as well. So looking a little bit deeper into these non-technical challenges, look at institutional controls. You know, for institutional controls at a complex site, you know, you have long time frames can be a big challenge, right? Your institutional controls in the United States historically have been problematic, mostly because of the overlap of different jurisdictions, both within municipalities or different governmental agencies. You know, they kind of get lost in the shuffle. So the longer that you have them in place, you know, the more important it is to have a robust system in place to be able to track those. Land use, you know, changing land use or water use, multiple owners on a property or changing of owners, site access, and funding. Funding is a big deal. You know, funding is a problem for states, federal environmental programs, and even private sites as well. And folks, some folks may not even realize on this call that, you know, often the long-term management of a complex Superfund site becomes the funding responsibility of the states. So the states themselves recognize the issues with managing these complex sites over long time frames and making sure that those site objectives can match up to something that can actually be achieved. And there's many more examples in the guidance to look at. The inset photo here, that's deer grazing on the Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge. Now, I don't think anyone who was working on Rocky Flats maybe 20 years or so ago, you know, ever probably thought about that site going from its nuclear handling facility to a wildlife refuge. But these are some of the changes that can occur with the site, and with it comes other challenges. So moving on, we have another case study to look at. John had mentioned, his love of the case studies within the guidance document, and that they are really well done. One of the things that I really appreciate with the case studies here is the fact that our stakeholders were involved in many of the case studies to give perspective. So we didn't just look at the technical aspects of a site. We also looked at how the stakeholders saw a site. And here at the Velsicol site in Michigan is a great example of that. This is another one where the stakeholders were deeply involved in developing the case study. And at Velsicol, what you had was 40 years of chemical plant operations, you know, that left residual oil and fire retardants, pesticides like DDT, and even low-level radioactive waste. And what happened was it impacted the water supplies, livestock, and residents' health, and economic hardships all occurred in this area because of the impacts that happened. You know, you unfortunately had financially distressed responsible parties, which created issues in terms of sufficient funding to address some needed cleanup items for the site. The residents formed their own community action group, and actually ended up writing a book about their struggles, which I haven't read, but I hear it's quite interesting. But ultimately, the contaminants were removed, and the remedial systems like pump and treat and slurry walls were installed, and city water supplies were replaced. But despite all of this effort that took place on this site, multiple cleanup actions and the decisions that that supported them, the regulators and community still struggle to this day to agree on the definition of success. So when you look at a site like this, now just think in your own mind, how would you have approached it? You know, would it have been that traditional, you know, the CSM approach where you look at all the technical aspects and just, you know, tackle them one by one? This is really a great example of how non-technical challenges can extend beyond the technical aspects of the traditional CSM. The issues with this community, with their economics, with their health, with, you know, their livestock, those were critical to the decision process and how things would transpire. So part of this is, in our guidance, the ITRC guidance, we do recommend, you know, a paradigm shift for conceptual site models, one that integrates these non-technical challenges as well as technical. And we're going to look at that a little bit closer. So what do we mean by that? Well, I mentioned previously that CSMs typically describe, you know, technical characteristics. But we think there needs to be a balance with these non-technical challenges that account for these site that are accounted for in these site decision documents. And some examples of that are like the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, or in California, the California Environmental Quality Act. This particular slide is a representation of US EPA's 2011 approach to developing a CSM, and we think it's a good reference. Now, this approach establishes project milestones that are based on site knowledge and stakeholder input, and it continuously refines the CSM based on the new data and information. And we should all seek for a goal with these CSMs that there's sufficient depth and clarity to accurately assess risks and develop appropriate remediation strategies. You know, ultimately, I hope we'd all agree that a CSM should be a dynamic tool that's updated for both technical and non-technical considerations throughout the site's life cycle. So now I'll go towards wrap up here, and I wanted to leave you all with some of the lessons learned through our efforts with this guidance on the technical and non-technical challenges. And first was, we recognize that complex sites typically have multiple challenges. And these are both technical and non-technical challenges that can impede remediation and extend the time frame to achieve a desired end state considerably. And ultimately, if we can identify these challenges, we can improve the conceptual site model and maximize remedial effectiveness. And perhaps more importantly, can help establish site objectives that can be achieved within a reasonable time frame. You know, as an overarching consideration, we definitely would encourage seeking that early stakeholder engagement. You know, John had mentioned it, I'm going to reemphasize it. You know, if you can build some consensus around especially the remedial time frame predictions, it will really help settle down your site objectives such that your site objectives and the expectations for when you're going to achieve whatever end state you're after for this site is in alignment between the regulators, responsible party, and your stakeholders. And doing so, man, that will greatly reduce those complications that often arise just from the non-technical challenges. So with that, it's now time to learn how to quantify all this information. I'd like to introduce Claudia Waleka Hutchinson with Dow, and she'll discuss the remediation potential assessment. Claudia, over to you.
Thank you so much, Roy. Can everyone hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, great. So I'm going to move on to the next chapter, the remediation potential assessment. And okay, perfect. So so Roy talked about all the different site challenges and complexities. Once you identify your site challenges, you can conduct remediation potential assessment and to help you decide if adaptive site management is warranted due to all the complexities at the site. And what's important to note is that this is not a strict yes or no. Most sites, including relatively simple ones, will likely benefit from adaptive site management. But with sites with many layers of complexities to which you just heard Roy speak to, this will really be helpful. Okay, so the remediation potential assessment is it's really a screening tool, and it's based on a set of questions, and it uses a weight of evidence approach to assess if a site is likely to achieve remedial objectives in a reasonable time frame. This process relies on available site data and aligns expectations with actual remediation potential. And it promotes effective and transparent interactions among owners, regulators, stakeholders during regulatory decision making. So if the remediation potential at your site is high, well, then your objectives are attainable and you really don't have a complex site. But if the remediation potential is low, then adaptive site management may be really warranted at your site. So what we really have is then we have something to help us move and manage sites more effectively. So can we get there? Can we achieve our remedial objectives in a reasonable time frame? The example to the left there is an older gas station. It's a small site. It's a shallow contaminated site. The aquifer is sandy. Maybe low concentrations at the site, and constituents like benzene and petroleum constituents that attenuate fast, and really very little non-aqueous phase liquid. So this is a really simple site, no showstoppers here, no significant challenges to remediation. So really we don't need to read the complex site guidance to move forward with maybe closing the site. But then the example to the right is a much more bigger site, large site, deep contamination. Much of the sources may be under buildings, pretty heterogeneous. You've got sand, silt, fractured clays at the site, so you've got a matrix diffusion going on. Not much biodegradation occurring, and you need to remediate to three orders. You need to bring down the concentrations by three orders of magnitude. So, this site has challenges of every corner. It's a perfect candidate for adaptive site management. So the remediation potential assessment is really intended to inform the remedial decision process and to determine if adaptive management process is beneficial. It can allow for greater transparency and facilitate future reviews of the processes, and it's pretty flexible. It can be applied at different life cycles and different parts of the sites or discrete segments of the site. But really the important part here is it's the journey, the reward. The process itself is important for it because it brings stakeholders together and it gets an aligned view of the site. So let's move on and figure out what the remediation potential does and does not do. So it allows flexibility and site-specific input and iterative process. So it can be refined based on increased site knowledge and data, just much like a CSM. It requires detailed supporting data on the nature and extent of the contamination. So, if you haven't done any drilling, you won't be able to evaluate the remediation potential. And it considers remediation potential of individual factors in context to other pertinent factors. So you're looking at things, a bunch of things together to evaluate the remediation potential. What it does not do is it does not provide a means to avoid requirements. So this is not a get-out-of-jail card. It does not evaluate whether a site is complex. It does not directly consider cost, although cost is in the implicit in some of the questions. And it does not produce a default decision because different sites have different factors that are weighed in together. Okay, so let's go through some of the key criteria for pre-remedy remediation potential assessment. Here we go. Okay, so the first one is accessibility. How accessible is the site physically or legally? So for a remediation geologist or engineer, the ideal plot would be something like what you're seeing there, flat, good weather, dry, pretty, something like a cow pasture maybe somewhere. But on the other hand, you can have a site that looks more something like this, covered with buildings, infrastructure, potentially hostile, angry people. So each site is different with regards to accessibility. The second key criteria, how difficult is it to drill at the site? So difficulty in drilling, which in the way of the complex site team, was envisioned as a combination of depth and what the type of material you are drilling through. So for example, so here for the top example here, we've got some folks near a target X there in the water that marks the spot, and they can use a hand auger, and they generally are having no difficulty drilling there, similar to a direct push. But if you look at the next example, and you look at the red X there, and you're supposed to drill through that to get to the water table that is near sea level, this is much more challenging, costly, time-consuming. Maybe it requires air rotary drilling. So we've got two completely different cases, two completely different answers as to the difficulty of drilling at the site. Okay, the third factor, the size of the area that needs to be remediated, right? It's pretty important. Maybe you have something pretty small, 20 by 20 feet in size, and maybe you can just, dig stuff up there so it's not as difficult to remediate than if you have something bigger, this is maybe 100 times bigger, so this provides a bigger challenge. And then, if your area that needs remediating is really big, say, maybe tens of acres, the treatment zone is, this obviously plays a role in remediating this area. So the area for the treatment zone is important both for the source zone segments and for the plume segments. Let me go back. Okay, the fourth key criteria, what contaminant concentration reduction is needed? So how far do you need to go? What are the concentrations now? And how long, how low do you have to go to meet your objectives? So remediation is an order of magnitude affair. Plume performance studies have shown that an average chlorinated solvent in situ remediation project has reduced the source concentration by about 90%. So, say that you're starting with 50 ppb and you're trying to reach a 5 ppb MCL or cleanup criteria, a 90% reduction is within a realm of possibilities. But what if you have to clean up to 99%? Well, that's a little more difficult, and maybe 99.9%, even more difficult. How about four orders of magnitude? 99.99% was rarely achieved in remediation performance studies. So the fifth criteria is the type of chemical and how easily it attenuates. That's really important. So the first example on this slide is toluene. Toluene is readily, it's degradable by microbes under both aerobic and anaerobic conditions. So it goes away relatively fast in plumes and many source zones. But what about if we have something like this compound down here, or set of compounds? So this is PCB, polychlorinated biphenyl. These don't really attenuate very much, and there's a lot of expense in dredging these, and because they're pretty recalcitrant. So the type of chemical this is a pretty important key criteria. So number six, so this question is really about the presence of how difficult is it to remove mass at your site. So this question is really about the presence of NAPL, and more importantly, the presence of matrix diffusion effects. So let's go to the first example here. Maybe this is a picture of your site. It's a sandbox, right? Maybe you have less difficult to remove mass than other places. Maybe matrix diffusion effects are not really a big thing at your site. But there's a pretty neat study that Tom Sale did at Colorado State University that allowed us to visualize matrix diffusion processes where the source is completely gone in this sandbox. So, this is fluorescent dye that was added, and you can see that there's nothing in the areas where it was sandy, but, the plume persists and goes on and on in the clay layers because of diffusion. So matrix diffusion effects are really important to remove mass from silts and clays in the subsurface. Okay, so John and Roy talked about case studies. So this is the Paducah gaseous diffusion plant in Kentucky, and so we brought up six key criteria for the pre-remedy remediation potential assessment. And this case study is really great because it demonstrates simple complexities at the site. So the first one, there's surface access, lots of buildings at the site, infrastructure in some parts of the site. So maybe there's drilling difficulty. Depth to water, it's kind of deep, the water table. Scale, that's pretty large plume there, so it's a large scale. Concentration reduction, long way to go in this DNAPL zone. attenuation. Some of the CVOCs will attenuate, but then there's, you know, the attenuation of other constituents may be less. And here you've got the DNAPL and the source zones. You've got clay and silt there, and you've got sands. And so, yes, DNAPL and lots of CVOCs dissolved in clays and silt via matrix diffusion. Okay, so the seventh question, we ask, how well will remediation perform if we had to predict this performance? To answer this question, one can use their own experience, information from vendors, or get information from multiple site performance studies, like the trials done in medical field. So the complex site document cites three example sources of performance information for chlorinated solvent source zones. So we've got the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Source Strategy Guide from 2011, summarizes knowledge at that time. We have the most a more recent paper by Hans Struh, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and a whole host of second, third, and all the way to 10 co-authors. And then a recent ESTCP study completed in 2016 by Travis McGuire and his colleagues at GSI, where they data mined and analyzed the before and after groundwater concentrations at 235 sites where remediation performance was analyzed. So we're standing on the shoulder of giants in terms of series of studies. Okay, and the last key criteria in pre-remedy remediation potential assessment. This question number 8 is really all about compiling all this data to try to answer the key question, what is the predicted remediation timeframe? So the figure to the right there is the DOE site in Kentucky, and it shows remediation time in years from their models and analyses of different cases. And what's relevant to see is that the green dotted line really incorporates biodegradation. And you can see that concentrations go down in 50 years when that process is accounted for in the whole matrix, versus the line to the very left does not account any kind of degradation. And it shows a long tail and a long time to reach achieve site objectives. And the table, this table on the bottom just shows publicly available and free tools and models that can be used to help estimate remediation timeframes. So you've got US EPA's REMCLOR and REMFUEL models, natural attenuation software, matrix diffusion, and concentrations versus time first order rate calculations. Okay. So the 8 evaluation criteria questions can be organized into a matrix and then individually answered as high, moderate, or low likelihood of achieving remediation objectives. You basically at the end assess a conclusion. This is a semi-quantitative process, so which really helps you identify what is the likelihood of reaching your remediation potential. While assessing the answers to the evaluation criteria questions, the site owners, regulators, and stakeholders may choose to give more weight up to some of the questions than others, may substitute questions with more pertinent ones to their site. So it's very adaptive. And now let's go through and let me go back. So now let's walk through how to apply the 8 factors in a weight of evidence approach. So let's look at access. So let's say that that most of the site segment is cleared, and that there are some buildings and roads which will be hard to drill through for remediation. So let's give that a moderate. It's pretty shallow stuff. So it's less than 30 feet, so direct push can be used. So there's really no problems with drilling. It's an average site for most remediation projects, about 10,000 yards, so let's put that as moderate in scale. So the concentration at this site are high. They're 50,000 parts per billion TCE, so pretty high concentrations. The MCL is 5 ppb, so we need 4 orders of magnitude concentration reduction, so let's give that a low. Attenuation. There's some biodegradation occurring at the site, but maybe it's stalled at cis DCE, so let's give that a moderate. In terms of difficult to remove mass, lots of matrix diffusion in this thick clay of this old site, so let's give that a low. Technology performance. Not too many technologies successfully achieved 4 orders of magnitude concentration reduction, so let's give this a low. Time frame, the model put this at over 100 years. let's give that a low as well. And so now we weigh all the categories. If we weigh all of these categories the same, we get one high, three moderate, and four low. So by a weight of evidence approach, it looks like it is less likely that existing technologies can achieve remediation objectives, and therefore adaptive site management is really going to be important at moving ahead at this site. Wanted to mention that there's a lot of flexibility for stakeholders. Stakeholders can weigh one category more than another at a particular site. They can certainly exclude categories that don't make sense. The goal is to really engage everyone in these sticky technical issues and try to come to some type of agreement about where we can reach some, you know, about how we can reach our objectives. Okay, so we talked about pre-remedy. This tool can be used in the early journey or in the post-remedy selection as well. But this time, it you know, obviously has different questions. So let's go through some of those questions. Has the existing remedy been effectively operated and maintained at the site? Are aquifer conditions or contaminant sources adequately characterized? Have they changed? So has the conceptual site model changed over time? Are concentration reductions occurring at the rate anticipated? Does the selected remedy address contaminants and/or hydrological conditions? And can interim or site objectives be met with other technologies within a reasonable time frame? So the first four questions really pertain to the current implemented remedy, where the last one really is relevant to unproven technologies. So after concluding that reaching interim objective is unlikely, and other technologies cannot achieve interim objectives, then choosing adaptive site management is the next step. So just to summarize, the remediation potential assessment is a screening tool, provides a valuable process. It does not produce a default decision. You answer technical questions and use weight of evidence to assess if a site is likely to achieve remediation objectives. It allows flexibility and site-specific input in an iterative process. And at the end, the goal is to determine if site objectives are likely attainable or if remediation potential is low and adaptive site management will be important. With this, I will turn it over to Juliana for our first Q&A question.
Thanks, Claudia. We do now have time for questions. If you'd like, you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. While we're waiting for our first few questions to come in, I'm going to tell you about some upcoming classes from ITRC. On August 14, we're offering a class on long-term contaminant management using institutional controls, and we've mentioned institutional controls earlier in today's training. August 16, bioavailability of contaminants in soil, considerations for human health risk assessment. We also have a classroom training coming up on petroleum vapor intrusion, and that's October 10 and 11 in the Seattle area. And in the Q&A pod, I've put in some information where you can follow links to register for these upcoming training events from ITRC. Again, all participants are welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod. If you're on the phone line, you're welcome to unmute and jump in and ask a question out loud. I'll also remind you at this point, at the end of the training class, we are looking for you to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. We appreciate you taking a few minutes at the end to fill out the form. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. We have a question that's come in. If the assessment had indicated the likelihood of achieving objectives was high, the default remedial option would then be pre-designed remedial approach. What if the assessment was at moderate?
Yeah, I'll take that. This is Claudia. Yeah, basically, if it's moderate, you can go through the process again. You can use the tool again.
For Claudia, do you think the RPA criteria for the concentration reduction for technology performance are redundant? Again, so are the criteria redundant between the concentration reduction and the technology performance?
I don't think so. I don't know. I don't know if somebody else can maybe answer that better than I can, if I'm understanding the question correctly, but I don't think they are.
Yeah, and this is Roy. One thing that I think add to the questions being posed is with the RPA, recognize that the criteria you put on there is subjective. It's really what the stakeholders, regulators, responsible parties think are the most appropriate criteria to evaluate a site. So if you do see something that you think is redundant, you have the ability to change out that particular item and put in something else you think might be more suitable for the situation that you're dealing with.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Right, it's very site specific. So it's very flexible in the sense that you can adjust it and weigh things more than others.
As we're waiting for additional questions, Sam Brock, have you been able to join the call, and are you able to unmute? And remember, it's #6 to unmute. So Sam's our presenter in the second half of today's training, so I'll check with him offline to make sure that he's able to unmute his phone for joining today's class. We don't have any more questions at the moment, so we'll go ahead and continue on to the second half of the training. If you are typing in a question, I encourage you to continue typing. We'll try to get to that during our second question and answer break, and I do hope we'll have extra time now for that second question and answer break since this one's been pretty short. We'll continue on now with the second half of today's training, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Elizabeth Hawley at GeoSyntech Consultants. Elizabeth?
Thank you, Juliana. So I'm going to be presenting the next section of the training, which is on adaptive remedy selection. So at this point, we would have completed the remediation potential assessment and determined that our site has low remediation potential and might benefit from adaptive site management. So the first stage is the adaptive remedy selection. And the content that I'm going to be discussing here is primarily from Chapter 4 of our guidance document. The main learning objective for this section of the training is understanding and applying some of the adaptive site management principles during remedy selection. So we'll take a closer look at the adaptive site management process, which is shown on the flowchart, Figure 1 from our guidance document. And on slide 56, we're revisiting the flowchart and focusing on the three steps that are shown in light blue, which relate to the adaptive remedy selection. So those include refining the conceptual site model, setting or revisiting site objectives, and then developing the interim objectives and adaptive remedial strategy. So a number of complex sites may already have remedies in place. And note that at those sites, there might be a need to reevaluate the remedy. So we show that on our flowchart by the arrow that comes from these decision points along the right-hand side of the figure and point to a need to reevaluate the remedy basis. And we have a poll question for you at this point, just asking how many people in our audience today working at complex sites have needed to revisit a remedy. And in addition, if you did need to revisit a remedy, the second half of our poll question is what actions were taken, and you can select all that apply for that second portion. So while people are completing the poll, I just wanted to mention that our flowchart incorporates those actions that were taken through including like remedy modifications and improvements that we're terming optimization, as well as considering implementing a contingency remedy if one is specified. So our poll is showing that it looks like most of our audience does have experience with revisiting remedy at complex sites, and maybe a few others think that it's too soon to tell, but they may need to in the near future. So the takeaway here is if there's a need to reevaluate the remedy, you would need to, again, go through these three steps. So we're going to take a closer look at each of these three steps in the next slide. So the first is refining the conceptual site model. And the conceptual site model would need to be updated to describe the site challenges and the key uncertainties. And if we've already implemented a remedy and it's failed to meet our performance expectations, we may have learned something through that process that we can use to improve the conceptual site model. We may now have more insights into what is inhibiting remedial progress, what previous assumptions maybe have changed since that previous decision, and then more importantly, what data gaps still remain and what uncertainties still remain that are limiting us at the site. And I don't think there's anything too new here, but again, just reiterating that it's very consistent with previous guidance that's emphasized that the conceptual site model is dynamic, and it's really important to update that before making key decisions. We have included a number of tools for remedy evaluation listed in Appendix D of our guidance, and would also refer you to the integrated site characterization approach that was described in a previous ITRC document from 2015, which could help in updating the conceptual site model. So as an example of a tool that could be used to improve a conceptual site model is a 14-compartment model. And this was actually used at one of our detailed case study sites, which was an industrial site in Australia. And at that site, they had a pretty large environmental release due to a grass fire at a drum storage area. There were hundreds of drums of chlorinated hydrocarbons and a plume that extended into this underlying fractured basalt aquifer and also followed underground sewer lines for several kilometers. So a number of complexities here. The good news is that they've captured some of the complexities and the and transport pathways and incorporated that into their conceptual site model. One other thing they did was use a model like this to estimate the magnitude of contamination for different media, so soil vapor, NAPL, groundwater, and sorb contamination that was present in both the high permeability and low permeability zones, and considered contamination in both the source area and in the plume. So basically providing a more holistic view of the problem and building awareness within their team and among reviewers as to which compartments of contamination would need to be addressed by the remedial technologies. So that's just an example of a conceptual site model tool that might be of use. The next stage would be to set or revisit the site objective. So after updating the conceptual site model, setting or revisiting site objective. And that by that I mean the overall remedial expectations at the site, including protecting human health and the environment, or meeting in some regulatory programs, meeting ARARs, for example. And when you're setting site objectives, you might have different objectives for different units of the site. So different hydrogeologic units or operable units, which we term site segments, may have different site objectives. It's important to consider the complexities that are present at the site during this process and revisit site objectives if necessary with the purpose of agreeing that the site objectives are achievable within a reasonable time frame. So some typical site objectives at a CERCLA site, sites in the Superfund program, would be ensuring that all final remedies are protective of human health and the environment and also comply with the applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, termed ARRs. The exception to that is if a site meets one of six different criteria for an ARR waiver. And the first, I will focus more on these last two, which would be greater risk and technical impracticability, as they were probably most applicable at complex sites. So an ARAR could be waived if Complying with that AROR would result in greater risk to human health and the environment than not complying. From our review of CERCLA sites, it seems that the greater risk waiver has only been implemented at a few sites, so there is not a lot of precedent in terms of understanding how that waiver would be applied at a complex site. The second option that has been used at complex sites is the technical impracticability, or TI, waiver. That has been used at about 85 CERCLA sites with 91 waivers granted as of 2012. And it's also been used as a contingency waiver written and described as that in records of decision at many other complex sites. So we have another poll question for you, which is how many of you in the audience have evaluated the applicability of an AROR waiver? And that could be a formal evaluation, preparing a TI evaluation report, for example, or just considering it but not getting to the stage of formally evaluating it, which would speak, I think, more to awareness of it. And then a second half of the poll question is what approach was selected following the evaluation, an AROR waiver or some other approach, unknown or not applicable. So it looks like a number in the audience, about one-third, I would say, have evaluated the applicability of the TI waiver. So in our next slide, I can walk through what that looks like. We have a case study, which is the Copper's Oroville Wood Treatment Facility in Northern California. And an AROR waiver based on technical impracticability was used at this site. The site was contaminated with creosote, DNAPL, and PCP, pentafluorophenol, and dioxins and furans. And the remedy was amended in 1999 to include a TI waiver for a four-acre area, which essentially changed the goal within that area from restoration to containment. And the decision to include this TI waiver followed a significant effort to identify technologies that could meet the cleanup goals within that area. They did a number of different technology-specific treatability studies. And ultimately, the remedy called for excavation, on-site landfill, and industrial use restriction, as well as the TI waiver. There's more details about this site in our document, as well as more details on the rationale for the TI waiver approval. Another option at CERCLA sites is alternate concentration limits. These are authorized by CERCLA regulations under specific conditions, so they can only be used for groundwater if groundwater is discharging to surface water, there's no statistically significant increase in concentrations downstream of that discharge as a result of the discharge, and there's no exposure to the off-site contaminated groundwater prior to that point of discharge. And we note in our guidance that there have been no CERCLA sites that have used ACLs since 2005, to our knowledge. And the 2005 corresponds to the date of an EPA memo that outlined the criteria for using alternate concentration limits at CERCLA sites. So I think it is used more often at RCRA sites and other state programs. For RCRA and other state programs, it's harder to find comprehensive information on acceptable approaches. And that's because the RCRA is typically administered by the state, so there's not one single database like there is for CERCLA sites, for those of you that are more familiar maybe with international regulations, for example. But ITRC is in a great position to ask the states directly. So early on in our team process, we surveyed the state points of contact. And we asked them, does your state or tribal program allow the following to meet site objectives? And we listed about 25 different approaches that we could think of as a team, including institutional controls, adopting points of compliance, using low-threat closure criteria, and more. And we asked the states if they use those approaches as a primary means, and then also if they use those approaches if the original remedy was failing to meet the site objectives. And several states indicated they had more flexibility to adjust the site objectives after the remedy had been implemented and had failed to meet those performance expectations. So here is some of the results from the state survey. The bar graph shows the number of states that indicated they were using each approach. And we found that it was pretty common for states to use risk-based, site-specific criteria as expected, institutional controls, and designated points of compliance, also considering background concentrations. But in contrast, only about 50% of the states indicated that they adjusted site objectives using alternate concentration limits or technical and practicability waivers or similar language from their state regulatory programs, pool management zones, low threat closure criteria. But nevertheless, these approaches are described in our guidance, and we provide some examples of case studies that have implemented those as well as state program language for determining whether or not those are applicable at your site. So that's kind of a summary of our guidance on setting or revisiting the site objectives. The third step in this process would be developing interim objectives and an adaptive remedial strategy. So interim objectives are designed as steps or milestones for achieving the overall site objective. There's a saying, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? I didn't have a picture of that, so we're making do with an apple, but you get the idea. Or how do you train for a marathon by running short distances every day? And that gives you the idea of interim objectives. They might be specific to a technology or to a particular area of the site, like a plume or a particular geological unit. And achieving an interim objective would lead you to the next interim objective and the next phase of remediation. So we have another poll question here just to get some feedback on the concept of interim objectives. We think that's a key concept from our guidance and just want to make sure that people get this or I can spend more time discussing it. The poll question is just basically asking you to distinguish between site objectives or interim objectives. And the examples that we give are restoring groundwater to beneficial use and reducing mass flux by 50% within 5 years so that hydraulic control is no longer needed. So it looks like people get this, this difference. Thank you. I'll just go through this next slide pretty quickly then. But the idea is it's important at complex sites to set interim objectives, not just long-term site objectives, and to think in terms of milestones that are achievable and where you can measure your progress towards achieving them over a shorter time period, rather than thinking about the overall goal, which may be, you know, on the order of hundreds of years from today. And eventually sketching out smart interim objectives that can be related to particular areas of the site or contaminated media or to a particular technology, and using those interim objectives as a basis for assessing the remedy performance. So before finalizing the interim objectives, I think that the adaptive remedy, the remedial strategy, is kind of built in parallel with those objectives. So from that perspective, shifting to our remedial strategy, we would start by identifying technologies and other approaches that could be potential components of a coordinated remedy for the site. And keeping in mind that we may end up using multiple technologies either at one time or in a phased approach over time to address the contamination. But for now, we're just asking, what are the tools in the toolbox? What are the management strategies and technologies we can choose from? And this is just one portion of the type of detail that is available in our guidance document as sort of an overview and providing references for additional information when considering these technologies. The next step would be comparing remedial approaches. So following the regulatory process for this, you would use the 9 criteria and a feasibility study process at a CERCLA site or at a RCRA site using similar threshold criteria and balancing criteria. And we've outlined a list of additional considerations at this stage to take into account at complex sites. So the first would be, how does each remedial approach address the complexities? And other things to consider, additional consideration, level of confidence in the ability to implement the remedy, synergy with other technologies or approaches, adaptability of a technology over time, whether or not information would be gained to improve future decision making. So this is that feedback to the conceptual site model. And considering the robustness of the design that is specified, whether or not we've specified interim objectives and performance metrics, and thought about how we would monitor performance and use that data to assess the technology performance. And other considerations, for example, whether modeling might be required to predict remedy performance over time, or whether one approach maybe is more green or sustainable compared to others. And either during the remedy evaluation or selection, you could prepare a table or a matrix that just puts together this information about site objectives and the remedy components for each area or segment of your site, and see how you're aligning your technologies with site objectives. And for your selected remedy, you could add another level of detail and think in terms of interim objectives as well. So that might be another column here in the table. Such as source treatment, source removal, containment, exposure control, maybe returning some portions of the site to beneficial reuse, and see how your technologies and other management strategies like institutional controls are working together to achieve those interim objectives. One of the case studies in our document is the Rocky Mountain Arsenal in Colorado. And this is a former chemical weapons manufacturing facility that was built in 1942 to support World War II efforts and continued its operations into the 1950s. And today, the Rocky Mountain Arsenal site is currently one of the largest urban wildlife refuges in the United States. It's 12,500 acres. And I mention it here as an example of thinking of returning portions of the site to beneficial reuse. The site has land use restrictions in perpetuity that restrict residential development or use and restrict any type of agricultural use or human consumption of fish and game. The remedy also limits access to the capped and covered areas. And the on-site area, as shown by the inset here in the photo, has been capped following extensive excavation of the top 10 feet, and there are boundary pump and treat systems operating. So this table shows how the interim and final remedy components might map to the site objectives for Rocky Mountain Arsenal. This site did not actually approach their remedy from the perspective of adaptive site management, but you can see some themes here from their technology that we could use to map to some interim objectives. And we see they're using some pretty common remedies for containment, source treatment, removal, but also some more unique elements like a medical monitoring program. They have a trust fund in place for long-term O&M. And also there's a potable water supply and distribution as part of their remedy as well. So the final step is documenting the remedial approach, basically articulating how the components of the remedial approach work together, either at one time for different areas of the site, as well as over time as more of an adaptive remedy over time. You could use a table, as we described in the previous slide, to summarize the technologies and other remedy components and the interim objectives and performance metrics. Basically, you would follow regulatory guidelines for how and when to document the remedial approach, and then also describe when and how to transition from one technology to the next. And we'll talk about that a little more in the next segment of our training. Basically, strategy adaptation guided by performance over time. And throughout this process of remedy selection, there are opportunities to involve stakeholders and tribes. Our team was fortunate to have multiple stakeholders on the team, who had direct experience representing communities that have been impacted by environmental contamination. So they shared their knowledge and gave some examples of how community engagement can benefit the site remedy, as well as more, I guess, tips for interested stakeholders and tribal representatives to get more engaged in the process. Some examples that are described in Section 7 of our guidance document include tips for accessing information and creating forums. Some examples of how community has influenced key decisions at complex sites. And also some advice regarding technical assistance grants and advisory boards as well. And then from the perspective of responsible parties, the document also includes some tips for increasing stakeholder and tribal engagement. And those recommendations are summarized here on the slide, as well as in Chapter 7 of the guidance. Some examples include seeking out community members, providing them with tools to participate constructively. In some cases, that might be a community advisor. Building trust for effective outreach, organizing public meetings. Something just as basic as sharing technical documents and information and working with the media. So just to summarize in this section, I wanted to reiterate some key principles of adaptive site management. The importance of refining the conceptual site model, as well as revisiting site objectives to determine if they're achievable within a reasonable time frame. And we talked about several different approaches within CERCLA and RCRA and other state programs for setting achievable site objectives. We also talked about building an adaptive remedial strategy, considering different site segments, using multiple technologies and approaches in those different areas and over time. And then setting interim objectives and performance metrics to guide remedy progress over the short term. So our final learning objective is developing a long-term performance-based action plan, and that's discussed in Chapter 5 of our guidance. So I'm going to turn it over now to Sam Brock of the Air Force Civil Engineer Center.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And with that, we're looking at slide 77 in case you happen to be following along in paper copy. But as we go forward, we're going to talk about how to develop a long-term performance-based action plan. And to do that, we'll look at the figure on the adaptive site management process. The dark blue figures reflect the steps and activities, the decisions that have to be implemented during long-term management. And we start that process with the development of a long-term management plan. And that plan is necessary to guide the implementation of the necessary tasks to accomplish to implement the remedy and the decisions that you are reflected in the diamonds further down in the chart that we'll get to a little in a few minutes.
Sam, a couple of people are having trouble hearing you, so if you could talk more directly into your handset, that would be great.
Does this help? I bent the mic. That should do it. So the purpose of the long-term management plan is to allow us to have a structure that we can learn as we go. Like conceptual site models, we expect the long-term management plan to be a flexible and living document. With time, performance will identify weak links in our strategy. We need a plan to help identify decisions and information necessary to inform our decision makers, and it provides a systematic way to engage stakeholders so that we can address the relevant concerns of the different parties. We have to keep in mind that completion strategies for complex sites are likely to span many decades, so we need a script that we can follow over a long time. We want to document what our remedy performance expectations are, and we want to document how rapidly and how we're going to measure progress of improvements that our remediation is accomplishing. We need to also expedite remedy reevaluations and, where necessary, transitions to different approaches. And we want to make those decisions in a timely manner. And to do that, we need a plan with the appropriate activities scheduled. So the components of that plan, as we've talked about, the strategy, the description of the selected remedy, the technologies and their objectives that will be implemented, what the expected performance over time is. We strongly advocate we need a performance model that will be the basis to predict or estimate what our anticipated remedy performance will be. We need a timeline as to how rapidly those changes will occur and what the criteria are for monitoring and periodic evaluations. What are the data requirements necessary to inform the decisions during the periodic evaluation? We'll need decision logic, preferably prepared in advance, to identify needs for optimization or transition. And we also advocate addressing the project risks. Now, if we think about the remediation potential assessment, that's an indicator of where you may encounter project risks. So as we begin to develop the strategy, the completion strategy then is the path of objectives or tasks that are necessary to achieve the objectives. They're likely to be iterative. It is, if we have high levels of contamination, we may very well need more than one technology to address that, deployed over time and considerations of time and space. We need to consider options with our remediation that allow us to maximize future land use. Elizabeth gave us an example of the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. But similar adaptivity needs to be incorporated into our projects. And it's also crucial that we consult the relevant regulatory guidance and technical guidance in terms of developing our strategy. On slide 83, as we look at developing the long-term management plan, we also mentioned we need to address risks and uncertainty. These are risks related to remediation performance, perhaps uncertainty in elements of our characterization or source characterization or technology performance. And we refer you to an earlier ITRC document, RRM1, which is Project Risk Management, and it gives a systematic process to identify and respond to key risk events. It's got some checklists, some tools in there to help identify what the potential risk to technology performance may be, how you can systematically identify actions to address those contingencies if they occur, and then allows you to plan in advance for at least some of the contingencies that you may encounter over time. We next need to describe the selected remedy, and we look for a description for the remedy for each segment of the plume. For example, do we have a source area? Do we have a dissolve phase plume? Do we have a need to subdivide the dissolve phase plume into off-site and on-site components to the extent that that will affect how we build our strategy and our planning? Interim objectives are crucial, and we need performance metrics in terms of how we're going to measure those objectives. We may need to set those during planning. We would optimally set them during planning, but these objectives may need to be established or modified during the long-term management phase. And as we've mentioned a couple of times, the time frame predicted to meet that interim objective is important. We want to look at issues of characterization, but also plume dynamics in terms of reduction in levels of contamination. And your planning also needs to consider your long-term maintenance and your monitoring considerations. So an example of how we might describe or summarize the description of a strategy for our selected remedy is we look at the table here. It's table one from the guidance document, and it identifies some examples of the objective, the remedy component, and what the performance metric might look like. But if we're going to remediate contamination, we may do that with in-situ treatment. And then to monitor that, we want to monitor reduced contamination concentrations over time, targeting an order of magnitude reduction. And then there are similar metrics for controlling migration as a consequence of the remedy to either reduce flux or achieve capture if containment is the objective. And then some metrics dealing with prevention of exposure through engineering and institutional controls. An example of a performance model is the expected change in concentration at the site over a period of time. And that blue line you see on slide 86 can be the interim objective or the final objective, depending on where we're at in the life cycle of a site. But we normally expect a curve that reflects attenuation over time, and it's important to have this in mind for what's expected so that we can judge our progress as we get into the periodic evaluations in a couple of minutes. Now, as we look at the diamonds here, or the last rectangle, is monitor and evaluate performance. So we have to have a monitoring plan. We mentioned that earlier. But we also need to schedule periodic performance evaluations. This needs to be site-specific. In the case of a CERCLA site, this would correspond with five-year reviews. You can set those shorter or longer depending on the expected time frame and the particular remedy that you're evaluating. And the monitoring program then needs to be aligned with the performance objectives and the periodic evaluation schedule. You need to design the monitoring program so that it produces the data necessary to evaluate remedy performance when you get to that step in the process. So an example of how monitoring performance would look, we've drawn a picture here, is the green curve on the slide represents the performance model that we looked at a couple of slides ago. We've implemented a remedy represented by the black dashes at a point in time. In this case, it's soil vapor extraction. In a year or so, we noticed that we started out rapid reductions, and then those reductions began to taper off. And we've drawn a band that is one standard deviation based on the data to above the expected line, which is the yellow zone. And then we've identified a red zone, which is a threshold beyond acceptable performance, where we would want to look at implementing an intervention. Now, as we notice the black dash line, proceeds from the green zone into the yellow zone, and then you'll see in the yellow zone there's a deviation in the slope. The dash line turns green, and that corresponds to a modification to the remedy. In this case, the soil vapor extraction was enhanced with the thermal element to heat the substrate, and we can see that there was an improvement in performance, that the green line starts to approach the green again, so that we're getting closer to our predicted performance at the beginning, but then we see that tail off and start to approach an asymptotic concentration and eventually proceeds to the red zone. When that performance gets into the red zone, it's necessary to go back to our flow diagram and reassess our remedy. So in order to design these periodic performance evaluations, there's a periodic evaluation checklist. It's table 13 in the guidance document, and this gives examples of how to address considerations of site characterization, the properties of the contaminant, as well as properties of the technology performance, how we're going to evaluate the performance, and whether or not how we're going to identify alternative technologies that may be appropriate for our decision support. I would advocate that if you have a legacy site, we would address these checklist examples in the periodic evaluation that we would schedule as we take over management or reconsideration of our approach. However, if we have new sites, I would commend this evaluation checklist as a means of understanding the adequacy of our characterization and our ability to design and implement an effective remedy. We advocate that we establish decision logic, and in this case, when we get to our periodic evaluation, we go through a series of four decisions. The first one being, is the interim objective met? The next one is, a site clean, in which case we're done, if represented by the green circle at the bottom. For complex sites, that's presented as for conceptual completeness, but more than likely our interim objectives are going to take longer than one periodic performance cycle. And then we have the second decision we have to make is progress acceptable? And that reflects what was going on in the three-colored performance example we had a slide or two ago. And then if progress is unacceptable, we have to ask questions about, can the remedy be optimized, modified in some way to improve performance? And if that doesn't work, then we have to go to, is a contingency remedy appropriate? And as Elizabeth pointed out in the decision document, has that been accounted for in the record of decision, or is that a decision that we have to make? And you'll notice that the no answer goes up to the top of the diagram, where we would cycle back through the kinds of RIFS process that Elizabeth described to us a few minutes ago in terms of reevaluating the site and reevaluating remedies if it's that severe. So as a case study, we wanted to give an example of a site in Colorado where it's a former defense facility. Contaminants were located in bedrock about 125 feet below surface. We had TCE and NDMA, which was a component of the fuels used on the site. And this represented a situation where it was difficult to gain access to the contamination. There wasn't a lot of water. Flow was difficult. It was there were several barriers to getting contamination out or getting in situ substrates injected. The remedy selected for the site was to use enhanced in situ bioremediation for TCE. With some pilot studies, it was determined that there was a way to stimulate bioreductive dechlorination. However, those concentrations reached asymptotic levels at a concentration above the remedial objective. For the NDMA, pilot studies of various in situ and ex situ approaches were performed and were demonstrated to be ineffective. There was no technology for in situ remediation, and ex situ remediation depended on pump and treat and was inordinately expensive with some technical limitations. And so the solution for the site then was to implement a technical impracticability for the NDMA in situ contamination in the source area, and then to transition the reductive dechlorination to MNA and institutional controls for the downgradient dissolved phase part of the plume. And this particular site also included an enforceable environmental covenant to address the institutional controls to maintain protectiveness for the dissolved phase plume that migrated off property. So, in summary, we hope we've illustrated the value of the plan and motivated you to be aggressive in your planning and systematic and thorough. We've enumerated the components that need to be considered, identified some considerations in the monitoring planning and the how you're going to evaluate performance, and also illustrated some conceptual approaches to how you might develop decision logic. And at this point, I'd like to turn it back to John Price, who will wrap this up and take us into the Q&A session.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. I know you're responsible for long-term management at a lot of sites, so I appreciate the points you emphasized in there. So this concludes our training on remediation management of complex sites. I'm going to do a three-minute wrap-up, and then we'll have a second Q&A session. So we introduced the guidance talking about the definition of complex sites. Roy talked about identifying the technical and non-technical challenges that can make a site complex. Claudia introduced a remediation potential assessment as a decision-making tool with the eight questions. Elizabeth talked about adaptive remedy selection and emphasized stakeholder engagement during that process. And then Sam just left us with understanding how to take your site into long-term management. We've talked about case studies throughout, and we've referenced several other ITRC guidances and other references that you can use to help you. So we talked about a process, adaptive site management. Science and technology are tools that we can use in that process. ITRC has a lot of other guidance documents that can help you develop those technologies. And Juliana, do we have a poll we can put up while I'm finishing this slide? So we'll go ahead and ask you a poll question about, after hearing this training, would you recommend using adaptive site management at your site? We've talked throughout about the importance of a robust and iterative conceptual site model. And iterative means you start out with a conceptual site model and have to be prepared to update it. And again, talking about stakeholder engagement, interim objectives need to be consensus-driven, which means engaging with everyone with an interest in the site. And it looks like most of our listeners are advocating yes on using adaptive site management. And then we talked about adaptive site management facilitates finding something that's achievable. And the path to getting an achievable goal is working through interim objectives. Okay, so let's talk about what you can do to make progress at complex sites. Okay, you can use and encourage use of this ITRC guidance. We went through this really quickly. You can spend a few hours reading the guidance and looking through the case studies. You can know your site. We've told you about how to identify technical and non-technical challenges. You can figure those out and put them into your conceptual site model. You can use a remediation potential assessment tool to come up with a qualitative assessment of whether or not that site is complex, and you can involve others in doing that assessment. You can apply adaptive site management principles after you've decided that your site is complex. And you can get your stakeholders involved early and develop consensus-based interim objectives. Again, it's really important to build that relationship, not just run a public participation process, but have a relationship where the stakeholders can participate in throughout the whole process. And then you can schedule periodic evaluations of your remedy. Your remedy is probably going to run for a long time, so periodically you need to evaluate its performance and make improvements or make some changes. You are the expert now. You've had this training. If you read the guidance, you're going to have the tools, and you can go out and do this. It's tough at complex sites, but we're all doing it. We're all struggling with the same challenges, and you can too. And with that, I'll turn it over to Juliana.
Thanks, John. We are going to have time for your questions, so please send in questions using that Q&A pod in the bottom right. And I've also just posted how to get the certificate. So if you are interested in a certificate for attending today's class, that is available from the feedback form. And right now it's only through the feedback form that you can generate the certificate. So be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box again. That's going to allow you, the system to generate a certificate for attending today's class. We also on the slide have links to additional resources. So if you want to see the links associated with today's class, we've talked about them throughout the class. We've pulled some of those together on a links page for you. I'm also opening our poll question again, the same one we asked earlier. Would you recommend using adaptive site management at your site? And also a new poll question, thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? And we have both of those set so that you can read the results that other people are entering in as well. Again, in the Q&A pod, you are welcome to send in questions. If you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute, and you're welcome to ask questions out loud. We had a couple questions come in, and one is related to slide 91, and I'm going to jump back to that slide. What is the yellow line? Is that the property boundary for the site? And oops, jumped back way too far. I'm going to jump to slide 91 to help answer that question. There you go. So on slide 91, what is that yellow line? And is it the property boundary?
Yes.
Thank you. We also have a question on slide 71. What does the biota layer shown on slide 71 consist of?
So I believe that's the Rocky Mountain Arsenal site, and they have a biota barrier, which is it's essentially crushed concrete separating the soil from the subgrade and the contaminated soil beneath that. So it's one other layer in their capping system.
Thank you. How feasible for complex sites is it to reopen if a new technology seems appropriate for a site with long-term M&A with institutional controls?
This is Roy. I can probably give a shot at that. Sam may want to chime in. So this question is a great question. It's actually one that was debated by the team quite a bit, especially the stakeholders, the public stakeholders were very interested in this particular issue. And the realistic answer is if a remedy is protective of human health and the environment, there is no, generally speaking, no regulatory requirement to reevaluate a protective remedy. That said, and the criteria for which you're looking at it under the long-term management program may be all passing acceptably, but there's always that consideration of, you know, is there a financial driver or incentive to say long-term M&A or some other technology that you may be using may not be the optimal in terms of the effectiveness, long-term effectiveness and cost. And those are considerations that certainly a responsible party can undertake at any time with consult with their regulatory agency. So hopefully that answers it. Sam, I don't know if you want to add on to that.
No, I think you covered it.
For complex sites and long-term remediation projects, multi-decade, maintaining stakeholder interest can be a challenge. How can we encourage stakeholder participation in the long term?
Yeah, this is John. I'll kind of jump in there. That's actually something that we're struggling with at the Hanford site in Washington where I work. We have some stakeholders that have been involved since the 1980s, and they're starting to, you know, move on to other things, retire, and just decide they don't want to continue working on it after another 30 years. And so we've really kind of struggled to bring on the next generation. And one of the things we're finding is we have to apply some different tools. So we're doing more with social media now, and we're doing kind of some unusual kind of more meet and greet type of public meetings, not issue specific, but really more educational to acquaint stakeholders with what the issues are. And we do an awful lot of outreach to universities to do some unusual things. I know one of my colleagues, not my organization, they've gone and done actually some presentations in like brew pubs where they've gone in and had a slideshow and so on and answer questions. So we're really looking for some different tools and not kind of doing the traditional outreach and public participation that we've done in the past.
What is the best way to get regulators who have not used adaptive management to accept the use of this process?
This is Sam. I'll take a stab at that. If you have a collaborative team process where you've got effective stakeholder involvement, which includes the regulators, the technical team, the cleanup contractor, the responsible party, if you systematically work through the issues and challenges of characterization and remedy selection with the regulators, and they understand the logic and basis for the decisions that are being put on the table, the majority of folks will, because it's so logical, and really other approaches don't work. In my area, we've demonstrated that. But generally speaking, the logic is compelling enough that a large percentage of the regulators will intuitively accept it.
Yeah, I would just, this is right, I would just add to that. The nice thing about this particular guidance is it was sponsored by state regulatory agencies, federal agencies, stakeholders, academia, and industry. So it's a really strong testament to a regulator that you may be dealing with that's not familiar with it to recognize what it's doing and how it's doing it. And I think it's just a matter of giving them some familiarization with this guidance document. Again, it's not a shortcut. It's really attempting to just help put a site onto a course that's really achievable within a reasonable time frame.
We have a couple more questions related to slide 91. So I'm going to jump back there, hopefully not too far this time. Was the affected aquifer used by humans, or was it agricultural water?
The water at the site was not used. It was limited in quantity. There wasn't the impacted aquifer or water-bearing strata was not highly productive, and there was no immediate use of that water for at least a 3 miles flow path to the plant boundary down gradient. So there was no agricultural contact, no human consumption contact, little surface water, no measured surface water impact. So it was a pretty contained, stable plume in the areas defined on the figure.
Thank you. Our participants are welcome to send in more questions in that Q&A pod in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. It's #6 to unmute your line. So we have some results for our poll. Would you recommend using adaptive site management at your site? So we have 90% that say yes, and another almost 8% that are unsure and need to learn more. And for both groups, I do encourage you to review the online guidance document, Remediation Management of Complex Sites. It's a great resource that you can use after today's training class. And then the next poll question, thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? We have someone who's going to review the progress at the site, reevaluate a tough site. Great answer there. CMS refinement, and I think that's a very common thing with a lot of our ITRC trainings is to refine that conceptual site model. We don't have any more questions for now, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. If you do end up having a question, you're welcome to email it to us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with trainers. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you haven't already, please fill out the feedback form. That form will continue to be available, so if you have any trouble getting to it right now, it will be available in the future. So in the next couple of days, if you do have a chance, please fill out the feedback. More information about